Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about the state of the war in Ukraine, what's happening more than 20 months into Russia's full-scale invasion, and about the fate and future of Western support for Kyiv amid shifting developments in the United States, Europe, and the Middle East and elsewhere. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Sam Green, a professor at the Russia Institute at King's College London, director of Democratic Resilience at the Center for European Policy Analysis, and co-author of the book Putin versus the People. Thanks very much for joining me, Sam.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
All right. It's great to have you on the podcast again. Now, the first thing I want to ask about is the state of Western support for Ukraine. A lot of things have happened this month that have already affected or could substantially affect, I think, levels of support in general, and specifically financial and military aid for Kyiv. From the United States and Europe and other countries and regions as well. Today is October 30th. On September 30th, the U.S. Congress averted a shutdown of the government by passing a stopgap spending bill. But in doing so, lawmakers removed $6 billion in funding for Ukraine, leaving the fate of further U.S. aid to Ukraine unclear. And it's still unclear today. While funding for Ukraine was dropped in that bill, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican who was Speaker of the House of Representatives, had been widely expected to propose a separate measure on aid to Ukraine, and President Joe Biden was urging him to do this quickly. But McCarthy was ousted from the Speaker's post on October 3rd, adding to the uncertainty. And the hard-right Republicans who led the effort to unseat him are opposed to additional aid to Ukraine. Now, 4 days after that, on October 7th, something much more momentous happened. Hamas attacked Israel, igniting a new war in the Middle East that has diverted attention from Russia's war against Ukraine, particularly, I think, in the United States, perhaps because of its close ties with Israel. But also affecting the way the war in Ukraine is viewed around the world. Now, the effect on the fate of U.S. funding for Ukraine is not yet clear. Possibly this could actually speed up approval, potentially, as the White House has proposed bundling funding for Ukraine and Israel together in a single package with funding for a few other things. However, last week, after three other U.S. lawmakers who sought the speaker post failed to get enough votes, a new speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives was elected, and he says he'll seek aid for Israel first. I should also mention Slovakia, where an election that was held on September 30th also has resulted in the return to power of a prime minister who, like Viktor Orban in neighboring Hungary, is sympathetic to Russia and essentially opposes aid to Ukraine. Sam, you're in the United States, and you've written about the process of the election of a new House Speaker after McCarthy's unprecedented ouster. But, of course, you've been watching developments in the Middle East and Europe and elsewhere as well. What do you make of all this in terms of Western support for Ukraine? Is it in serious jeopardy?
Well, look, first of all, I think we need to take a couple steps back and separate out some processes here. And there's a long-term story and there's a short-term story, neither of which are terribly, great, but neither of which are probably catastrophic either. The long-term story, right, and the long-term reality is that there have been some serious challenges emerging to support for Ukraine over a number of months. We've seen this coming from a distance. In some cases, we've worked to try to ameliorate that. But the biggest challenge that you put your finger on really is, the growing reluctance to support Ukraine among some in the U.S. political establishment, particularly in parts of the Republican Party. And if you do, you know, the vote counting, you go through both the House and the Senate, you will continue to find that a majority of Republicans, or at least a sufficient number of Republicans joining together with Democrats, are there to, you know, support Ukraine. But the reality is, we've seen with the ouster of McCarthy and with the difficulties that the House has had in selecting a replacement for the Speaker, is that those who are adamantly opposed to supporting Ukraine are in a structurally powerful position. Despite their relatively small numbers, they are in a position to shut down the House of Representatives as such, perhaps to shut down the U.S. government as such, and they are willing to make support for Ukraine, you know, one of the hills on which they're willing to die. Now, I think there's a bigger question about, you know, to what extent is that ideological? Why are they doing that? I think for the most part, it's a political calculation, and a fairly cynical one at that. This isn't a line that they believe that they can attack President Biden on going into the 2024 elections. It's one that they are already beginning to campaign on. It's one, you know, where they see a certain softness, particularly among Republican voters, but not only. And, you know, there I think some of the blame actually does need to shift to the administration itself. The president on 19th of October gave an Oval Office address in which he talked about both Ukraine and Israel together. He talked about the threats posed to the world that the U.S. would like to live in, and thus to U.S. national security and national interests, posed by aggressive actors, whether that be Vladimir Putin or whether that be Hamas. And he really began to make the case to the American people about the national security imperative of supporting Ukraine in a way that he really hadn't done since the beginning of the war. Most of what Biden has said to the American public up until the 19th of October was really about the moral and the emotional case for supporting Ukrainians, either democracies versus autocracies, standing up for victims and standing up against bullies and that kind of thing. And while that's important, I think the conclusion that the White House has come to is that if the Republicans are going to campaign against Ukraine, if they're going to make this an electoral issue, then it really is important to hold up the other side of the argument. So we will see what kind of impact that has. We have probably, you know, on the short-term front in the U.S., dodged a little bit of a bullet with the election of Mike Johnson. It might not feel that way to a lot of people, but his stance on Ukraine does strike me as somewhat softer than, say, Jim Jordan's stance, and there was a very real chance that he would become Speaker. Johnson has said that, you know, supporting Ukraine is something they would all like to do, but they want there to be oversight. The Ukrainians, incidentally, are perfectly happy for there to be oversight. They're fairly confident about the way in which American aid and money has been spent and managed in Ukraine, and for good reason. In fact, there has been oversight really from the very beginning. So I think that, you know, the likelihood is that some aid will come through. Whether Republicans will be minded to give the administration everything that it's asked for, and that's about $60 billion out of $105 billion supplemental package that the White House has put to Congress, is an open question. It's a political question. Obviously, you know, for Ukraine and for those, you know, who care about Ukraine, the best thing to do would be to get as much money as possible and to get it for, you know, a funding period that is as long as possible. The White House has asked for funding out through September 2024. And that, I think, you know, is good news. Again, they're being ambitious, but we'll have to wait and see what actually comes out of the political process. On the other side of the Atlantic, I think the news is, you know, again, you pointed to the elections in Slovakia, which are unpleasant for a lot of people, not least for people in Slovakia. But the reality is that, you know, the national security conversation, the hard security conversation around Ukraine is, in a lot of ways, and has been for a long time, more robust in Europe than it has been in the United States. We've seen, in fact, European Union members and European countries as a whole begin to spend more money, including on military aid for Ukraine, than the United States has spent in recent months, and really rallying to that cause as they've seen the difficulties that the U.S. has had in coming up with further commitments to Ukraine. And we see that reflected to a certain extent in the Polish elections, which you didn't mention, but which did bring to power a center-left coalition that, you know, both sides of the political spectrum in Ukraine have been committed to resisting Russia, in Poland have been committed to resisting Russia and supporting Ukraine. But this brings to power a government that is much more likely to have friendly relations with Brussels, to have friendly relations with Berlin, and with other key, both NATO and EU member capitals, which is going to leave Robert Fico in Bratislava and Viktor Orban in Budapest much more isolated than they otherwise would have been.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Sam. Yes, I guess as a cynical journalist, I mentioned sort of the negative development, at least in terms of support for Ukraine from the West, but not the more positive development of the Polish elections. So thanks for that. And also for pointing out your point about Mike Johnson, the new speaker, and you know his remarks or his stance on Ukraine. You know, I think the consensus was that Jim Jordan, you know, would be a worst case scenario. Just speaking of what I've read from and heard from analysts, and as you pointed out, Johnson did say, you know, we all want to support Ukraine, but we're going to look at want accountability and look at the details. I just wanted to follow up on one of your points and ask, you know, you mentioned Biden's Oval Office speech in which he started to make the case, you know, for a kind of a national security case for robust support to Ukraine. Now, do you think it's crucial, or do you think he needs to sort of continue making the case to step it up, or is that potentially dangerous in terms of with the election coming up?
I think the White House has been clearly reticent to have Biden be the face of this conflict and really to make this as a national security, national interest case to the United States. It does take some thinking and explaining to bring it home to some of the American public, at least, you know, exactly why this is in America's interest, in the interest of America's alliances and relationships, and why really the world that would emerge if Russia is allowed to be big victorious in this war is a world in which we don't really want to live. But that was a political calculation. I think partly it, maybe to avoid partisanship, they wanted to see if they could leave this as a conflict, a war essentially that people on both sides of the aisle were willing to support. But I think that policy has probably run its course, and so we are seeing, and hopefully will continue to see, the president being more front and center. Really, there is nobody, regardless of your partisan position, there is nobody in the U.S. political system, regardless of who the personalities or the parties are, who can make the national security case to the American public the way the president can. That is one thing to which Americans do look to their president. And I think that we can and hopefully, will see the president be much more forthright, much more present on this issue going forward. The reality, of course, is that U.S. presidential elections are not usually won and lost on foreign policy, and so I don't think we should expect Biden to see this to make this his core campaign issue. But there are things going on other than elections. The White House certainly recognizes that, and I would expect them to come up with more opportunities for Biden to make this case to the American public going forward.
All right. Thanks very much, Sam. Now, my second question is connected to the first. It's about the war itself, the war in Ukraine, Russia's war on Ukraine. Kind of an effort to take stock now, a little over 20 months since Russia launched its full-scale invasion on February 24th, 2022. It's also been almost 5 months since Ukraine began a major counteroffensive in early June. And Ukrainian forces have made gains, but so far they've been unable to achieve at least one of the main goals, which is to break Russia's hold on a corridor of land stretching along the Azov Sea coast from the Russian border to the isthmus that leads to Russian-occupied Crimea. And as before, it seems like there's no end in sight to the war, at least none that I can see happening before, say, the presidential elections next year in Russia in March and in the United States in November. And we've been doing reporting on this, and the Russian budget that's coming up is now going to be unprecedented amounts of money for military development, defense industry. So maybe this question is overly broad, but what's your assessment, I guess, of the state of the war and what will you be watching for in the coming weeks and months? And I guess another question, how much of an effect is the fate of the Western support for Kyiv likely to have?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that really is the key question. Look, I'm not a military analyst. I'm not going to pretend to be a military analyst. So I'm going to do what most of the rest of us have been doing since this war began, which is, you know, reading everything that Mike Kaufman, Rob Lee, and others have to say very, very carefully, following the trackers from the IWS and that kind of thing. Sorry, ISW and that kind of thing, right? So, you know, it is... it remains, I think, a fluid situation, even if the actual front lines have not been moving very much, right? I think we can allow ourselves to believe that because this looks and feels like a war of attrition, that there's not all that much that's actually happening on the front lines. And the reality is that, you know, there are people being killed on a daily basis, and there is stuff being destroyed on a daily basis. There is... there are tests being put to both sides militarily on a daily basis, and over time that may accumulate and may lead to unexpected developments. But I'm not in the business of predicting what those developments might be. Again, for me, I think it's a slightly longer term, mid to longer term story that is of interest, because that's the story I think that's going to determine where this war go. There's very little evidence that anybody's going to win an outright near-term victory on the battlefield anywhere in Ukraine that will be decisive and that will lead either side to stop fighting. Both capitals have clearly concluded, at least for the time being, that there is more to be gained on the battlefield and that the risks of stopping fighting for their geostrategic and national interests are too great. Right? And so this war will continue. Both sides are geared up for that war to continue. You mentioned that the Russians have been able to and continue to mobilize their economy as a wartime economy. They've stepped up production. We also see arms coming in from North Korea. We expect to see more arms coming in from Iran, although Iran at the moment obviously has other issues that it will be trying to deal with as well closer to home. But the Russians will keep putting material on the front line, even at increasing cost. And they will keep putting men on the front line, although there the limitations might be greater. I think the indication is that the Kremlin is unlikely to seek a massive new call-up of soldiers anytime before the presidential elections next March, and I would be skeptical that they would want to do that even after then. On the Western side, I think, you know, we are seeing the delivery of ATACMS, right, which are now already on the battlefield. We are seeing movements in directions of other weapon systems, including F-16s. We are seeing continued efforts to ramp up defense industrial production of all of the things that Ukraine needs to continue fighting, including some things that Ukraine does not have yet, right? And so we are seeing very clearly that Ukraine and its Western supporters are gearing up not simply for, you know, the end of this current offensive, whatever direction that might take, but for the offensive after that and the offensive after that and for defenses against whatever campaigns the Russians might decide to mount for further territorial gain from their perspective. Right. So the you know, as sort of sick as we all are to a certain extent of the phrase that, you know, we're in this for as long as it takes, I think that one of the things that Ukraine and the West really want to do is to communicate to Putin that, you know, if he is waiting for the West to lose its nerve, to lose interest, to lose its ability to continue supporting Ukraine, it's going to be waiting for a very long time. That, you know, is not a happy picture to a certain extent, because it means that, you know, that we are going to be locked in this conflict potentially for years to come. It's going to cost lives. And at the end of the day, it will be up to the Ukrainians to decide, you know, how and for how long and with what sorts of losses they do want to continue fighting. But I think it is important that, you know, every indication we're seeing, despite the difficulties we were just talking about on Capitol Hill, is that the West will be there to support the Ukrainians for, again, as long as the Ukrainians are willing and interested to fight.
All right. Thank you, Sam. I'm just going to apologize for asking another question that's related to kind of the military developments on the ground. But that's a great overview. But I just wanted to ask about the Ukrainian counteroffensive, you know, that started in June, you know, has made some progress. And maybe you've already answered this by indicating, you know, how far ahead both sides may be looking. You know, do you have any sense of how important, you know, there's been so much of a focus on the Ukrainian counteroffensive, and now there's sort of a Russian counteroffensive, at least in the east. Any sense of sort of how important, I guess, success or failure of this counteroffensive is?
Well, look, it would have been wonderful, right? Obviously, if the Ukrainians had succeeded in driving to the sea and splitting the Russian territories into two and making it much more difficult for Russia to operate. You know, I think, again, you talk to the military analysts and the people who look at this much more deeply and with much more expertise than I do, and I think there were very few people who actually believed that was likely to happen. You know, to the extent that the White House and the Pentagon were briefing people on Capitol Hill, they would have been getting the same message. The administration did not really expect that to happen either, which is why, you know, really from the beginning of this offensive, again, people have been gearing up, you know, for the next offensive and for the offensive after that. So, you know, I well, it's, you know, we might make in, sort of in the public space, in the public conversation, in the news media to a certain extent, a lot out of the success or failure of this offensive. I'm not inclined to you know, exaggerate its importance either for the course of the war or for the level of Western support for the war.
All right. Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Sam. We're going to wrap it up here. Thanks a lot for the kind of broad but also detailed, I think, assessment of what's going on, both in terms of the war on the ground and Western support. So thank you again for joining me, Sam.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Sam Green, a professor at the Russia Institute, King's College London, Director of Democratic Resilience at the Center for European Policy Analysis, or CEPA, and co-author of the book Putin versus the People. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.